to the station and put me on a train. I've got no expectations to pass through here again. Once I was a rich man, now I am so poor, but never in my sweet short life have I felt like this before. Your heart is like a diamond. You throw your pearls at swine, and as I watch you leaving me, you pack my peace of mind.
Rolling Stones wrapping up a Viva La Mock for this edition of it. An abridged version of the Viva La Mock radio program. Magnapop before that doing Big Stars 13 and start off that entire set with Malibu from Birthday Girl Courtney Love. My name is Paul. I am the Mockster. Thank you so much for tuning in. I will catch you again next week.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. My name is Steve, host of the Deep Blues Hour. I'll be here for the next 60 minutes, bringing you classic and traditional blues. In this hour, we're going to hear from The Black Ace from down in Texas. Some fine acoustic guitar blues. Brownie McGee as well, performing with Lightnin' Hopkins. Johnny Winter will give us some scorching blues towards the end of the program, but as well as Elmore James wailing on his harmonica from Chicago. It's all coming up here on this hour of the Deep Blues Hour. And we're going to start off the program today with Mr. Chris Kane from his Blind Pig record called Cuttin' Loose. Came out in 1990. Here he is, picking up the tab, Chris Kane, on the Deep Blues Hour.
Yeah, well, this is Kimani Mali, and you're listening to WRCT-FM. Keep it locked, Rasta.
Welcome, everybody. Hope everybody celebrating Thanksgiving has a good Thanksgiving planned. We will talk on the bonus show today. What are my plans? What are producer Pat's plans? Producer Pat's plans are much more interesting than mine. He will tell us all about it. Few stories that I did want to go over with you guys. This story has gotten quite a bit of attention. Multiple conservatives have quit Fox News over what they say is the increasing propaganda, particularly from Tucker Carlson. And it's interesting for what they say, and it's also interesting for what they don't say, and you'll see what I mean in a moment. This is about Jonah Goldberg and Stephen Hayes, who have resigned from Fox News, protesting the irresponsible voice of people like Tucker Carlson. Hayes and Goldberg announced Sunday night that they have resigned from Fox. The pair wrote in a blog post for The Dispatch, their online home, that Tucker Carlson's Patriot Purge propaganda film was the last straw. Fox News still does real reporting, and there are still responsible conservatives providing valuable opinion and analysis, they wrote, but the voices of the responsible are being drowned out by the irresponsible, and Carlson is the case in point. CNN and other news outlets described how Patriot Purge is disturbing evidence of right-wing radicalization, complete with January 6th denialism and paranoid descriptions of a new war on terror targeting Republicans with references to Guantanamo Bay and images of waterboarding. Now, this is interesting for a few different reasons. First of all, the resignation came Sunday night in advance of the one-hour propaganda documentary produced by Tucker Carlson about the Kyle Rittenhouse case and the full interview that Tucker Carlson did with Kyle Rittenhouse, which we covered yesterday, which are incredible propaganda pieces, total and full propaganda, lionizing and making a hero out of Kyle Rittenhouse, portraying him even as an expert on things like prosecutorial misconduct, self-defense, the FBI. I mean, completely out of this world propaganda. So it's interesting that it was the Patriot Purge thing that was sort of like the last straw. Now, it's interesting where these people draw the line. Goldberg and Hayes are certainly more along the lines of what we might call, I hate to use the term like normal conservatives, but sort of more traditional conservatives in the line of like Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney. In fact, mentioning Liz Cheney is interesting because Liz Cheney even tweeted out a thank you to Goldberg and Hayes for calling out the lies on Fox from that Patriot Purge propaganda piece, including the lies related to the 2020 election. So that's interesting because that's clearly a contingent. But it's interesting where people draw the line because Patriot Purge is over the top, but Fox has been radicalizing viewers forever in many different ways. And in the months of the aftermath of the 2020 election, they were giving voice to absolutely wacky conspiracy theorists with completely fact-free views on the election and on and on and on. So I don't want to belittle the fact that Goldberg and Hayes said, this is as far as we're going and this is too much and we've got to leave. That's fine. It's interesting because, and it's strange because the big picture of what Fox News is and what Fox News does really hasn't changed actually for a very long time. To be fair, Tucker has been particularly off the deep end lately with the anti-vax stuff, the Rittenhouse stuff, etc. So mentioning Tucker is sensible. That certainly makes sense. The other thing about this is they're likely to be replaced with wackier people. And this is one of the things where when Donald Trump during COVID, during his calling it administration of COVID doesn't even make sense. When he was president during the pandemic and Donald Trump started slamming Anthony Fauci, and increasingly people were asking, why doesn't Fauci quit? Why stay in this situation? We said, and maybe Fauci also said, I don't remember, I'm just kind of going from memory, that if he leaves, he may well be replaced with a yes person of some kind, rather than someone who's going to insist on telling us what the science actually is. And along those same lines, I don't expect that Goldberg and Hayes are going to be replaced on Fox News by more sensible people. And that's always a question that comes up when someone has had enough with something like Fox News and they say, I'm taking myself out of it. often they get replaced with even more radical voices, and that well may happen. But we're going to watch it, and it's always interesting to see where do they draw the line. Jonah Goldberg and Stephen Hayes drawing the line at the Patriot Purge film from Sunday. And it's not a crazy place to draw the line. It was a completely whacked out film. But it will be different for everyone. And of course, that same film, many conspiracy theorists seeing it and saying, now we have Fox as well. We got them. They're now with us. And that's obviously very, very scary. When we talk about consequences for perpetuating the lie that Donald Trump actually won the 2020 election, that Joe Biden actually stole the 2020 election, one group of people that participated in that is attorneys, attorneys filing bogus lawsuits. And we have some nice news. A judge has ordered pro-Trump attorneys who brought a frivolous election fraud case to pay more than $180,000 to defendants that they sued. Caitlin Polance writing about this for CNN. Two lawyers who went to court to claim voter fraud after the 2020 election must pay nearly $180,000 to the defendants. The judge wrote that their lawsuit aimed to manipulate gullible members of the public and foment public unrest. These are attorneys you may not be familiar with. This is not Lynn Wood, Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, Jenna Ellis. This is attorneys Gary Fielder and Ernest John Walker. They are going to have to pay attorneys' fees of $50,000 to Facebook, now known as Meta, $63,000 to Dominion Voting Systems, $63,000 to the nonprofit Center for Tech and Civil Life, $6,000 to the state of Pennsylvania, $5,000 to the state of Michigan. The judge, Neer Reiter, wrote in his order, they need to take responsibility for their misconduct. I believe that rather than a legitimate use of the legal system to seek redress for redressable grievances, this lawsuit has been used to manipulate gullible members of the public and foment public unrest. To that extent, this lawsuit has been an abuse of the legal system and an interference with the machinery of government. For all these reasons, I feel that a significant sanctions award is merited. This is fantastic. It's one thing to see them laughed out of court, told as they were with, was it 63 lawsuits, that there's no merit, that it's not going to go forward, that the judge is going to put a stop to it. That is good. But at a certain point, if it doesn't hit them in the pocketbook, proverbial pocketbook, it doesn't really disincentivize them from doing this again. And we have a legal system where if there's merit, they will be allowed to carry this forward. There was absolutely no merit here. The lawsuit from late December was an attempt to create a class action challenge on behalf of voters, including eight plaintiffs. Neurator wrote a scathing 68-page opinion condemning the lawsuit. The plaintiffs had no lawyers or experts able to support their claims of switched votes and government conspiracies, the judge noted, calling the lawsuit itself one enormous conspiracy theory. You will also recall that in August, a federal judge in Michigan sanctioned pro-Trump lawyers Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood, who I mentioned earlier, and other attorneys, ordering them to reimburse the attorney's fees that the city of Detroit and Michigan state officials paid. The judge said the lawyers who worked on Trump-aligned lawsuits seeking to challenge election results had engaged in litigation practices that were abusive and in turn sanctionable. These people have to be held accountable. They have to be held accountable because they are going to do this again. And we don't have to guess at whether they will do it again. They're telling us that they will do it again. They told us before the Virginia gubernatorial race that it looked like there was already fraud. Glenn Youngkin ultimately won. But if Glenn Youngkin had lost, they were going to do it again. We know that they have been explicit in saying, we're going to keep going with this. They don't really want solutions to the problem they claim exists. They want to use claims of voter fraud as a cudgel, as a mallet of sorts, to beat the public over the head when an election doesn't actually go their way. And there need to be consequences. And this is an excellent decision. We'll see if they actually pay the money. Want to remind everybody of a couple things. We are going to be off tomorrow, Thursday, as well as Friday for the Thanksgiving federal holiday here in the United States. I know that Most of our American viewers know about this, but I always get dozens and dozens of emails from around the world. David, sir, where are you? And it is Thanksgiving. We will be off for the rest of the week. Also, we've scheduled the next David Pakman Show viewer town hall. It's going to be on December 14th at 6 p.m. Eastern time. It will be, number one, open to anybody who wants to call in, but priority will be given to our website members, so you can get yourself signed up at joinpakman.com if you want a better chance to talk to me on the 14th. The entire event will stream live for whoever wants to watch it. It will be exclusively on the Pakman Live YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/PakmanLive. It won't be on our main YouTube channel. It won't be on Twitch. It won't be on Facebook. It'll be exclusively on the Pakman Live YouTube channel. So that's December 14th. And of course, you can sign up on our website, joinpakman.com, become a member. And as a member, you will also get access to today's bonus show, in which I will tell you my Thanksgiving plans. Very boring. But producer Pat will tell us his Thanksgiving plans. Very, very exciting. All right, we'll take a quick break and be back right after this. Remember that the David Pakman Show is primarily made possible by viewers and listeners like you through our membership program. You can sign up at joinpakman.com. Members get instant access to the daily bonus show, an extra show we produce just for you. You also get commercial-free audio and video feeds of the show, priority handling during our viewer town halls, the next of which is going to be on December 14th at 6 p.m. Eastern time. Let's hear from some people in the audience. Because of the shortened Thanksgiving week, we're doing our calls today instead of on the Friday show. We take calls via Discord at davidpakman.com/Discord. Let's first today speak with Gary from California. Gary, you're on the air. What's going on? Gary from California, you're on the air. Gary, we're hearing some pops coming from you. Are you able to unmute and talk to me?
Yeah. Can you hear?
Yes, I can. What's going on?
Okay. Sorry if there's stuff in the background, but I'm kind of new to the whole politics thing. I was wondering if there's any primer that I can read that would get me into, like, social democracy or Keynesian economic theory.
Yes, there are tons of books on those topics. I don't know that I have specific recommendations, but I, as a great place to start, go to the wiki page for any of these topics. And I know anybody can edit wiki, so before everybody jumps down my throat, go down to the sources where you will see source materials. And that's always a great place to start. A lot of these wiki pages have dozens or even hundreds of references that include articles and books that you can read. That's a good place to start. I don't know of any specific book on social democracy necessarily, but that's where I would recommend you start.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Gary from California, thanks very, very much for the call. Let's continue. Let's go next to Vince from Wisconsin. Vince, you're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, great. How you doing, David?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Vince.
All right, so I just had two questions. I had a brief question and a longer question.
All right.
My longer question is, what are your thoughts on Attorney General Merrick Garland's performance so far?
I don't know that he's done enough one way or the other to really evaluate his performance. He has put out some memoranda, as we might call them, saying that he's going to be looking into this or exploring that. I just don't think we have enough data points. I mean, he's been in his job months, and I don't know that I have anything substantive to say about his performance this way at this point in time.
Yeah, he seems pretty milquetoast to me. I mean, he's still sitting on charges for obstruction of justice charges for Trump. He's representing him, for God's sake, in that lawsuit. I believe it's E. Jean Carroll is her name, who accused him of rape.
Yeah.
And a defamation lawsuit.
I mean, that's going forward, as far as I know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Good. That's good.
Are you rolling dice in the background, by the way?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Oh,
my bad. No, I'm not rolling dice.
Oh, cool.
But so sorry about the noise. But My second question is, would you consider interviewing Brian Tyler Cohen at any point?
I mean, I don't know that it's for our show. Usually we don't interview people who just have like other channels like mine, but I would definitely do a collaboration okay. with him of some kind, like on a live stream. I think it'd be a better fit for that. But like on our show, you know, I don't tend to interview like Sam Cedar or Farron Cousins or that type of thing on the podcast, but okay. I would do a collaboration with him for sure.
Okay. All right. Thanks, David.
All right. My pleasure. Thanks for the call. Very much appreciate it. Let's go next to... let's go to Cliff from Seattle. Cliff, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Awesome. Oh, cool. I didn't really expect to get called on. I've been a big fan of yours for a bit now.
Thank you.
I was curious. I live in Washington State, as you can guess. Our last election, the one that elected Joe Biden, we also reelected Jay Inslee. Mm-hmm. And rather immediately, his big contender, the Republican candidate, started calling for saying it was voter fraud. There was massive voter fraud. And that didn't seem to really go anywhere in this state. Like, it wasn't taken seriously by our people in the state. He lost by about, I think it was 60% to 40% or so. But I'm really concerned that I see this being the tactic, the standing tactic that Republicans are going to use continuously.
Yes. Absolutely. And I've spoken about this before. Yeah, Jay Inslee defeated Lauren Culp by 13 points in 2020. It was 56 to 43, 57 to 43. And there were a few attempts from Republicans to push the voter fraud thing. It went nowhere because, number one, there's absolutely no factual basis for it. And number two, you know, a 13 and a half point loss. It's going to be very, very difficult to overcome in any serious way. But as I've said before, this is going to be, it's almost becoming a meme at this point, which is if we win, it was fine. And if we lose, it was voter fraud. We saw them lay the groundwork for it earlier this month in Virginia, because remember, before the election for the Virginia governor between Youngkin and McAuliffe, you started to see like there was a Republican state senator, Trump and others saying, looks like the Democrats are stealing it again. Youngkin ended up winning. They didn't say a word about it anymore. We won. Why? There's no fraud. We won. So it's a very dangerous precedent. And you're absolutely right.
Yeah. And, I don't know. I'm just concerned of like what that's going to do from how to combat it from the people that you know agree with it and believe it, and how we can neutralize that threat from the public.
See, here's the thing. For a lot of these people, they don't literally believe there was voter fraud. They believe that if you want to demonstrate your bona fides and commitment and devotion to the team, you say that you believe there was voter fraud, and it's a way that you virtue signal that you're part of the team. I think that for some of these people, they don't actually believe it. They just say that they believe it. It doesn't actually make it less dangerous, though.
Yeah, I agree. I've got some family that agree that there was fraud and such, and it's really... frustrating.
Do you think they literally believe it, or that they believe it's what you have to say to prove you're on the right team?
My impression is that they believe it, but okay. I guess I haven't really considered that maybe it is a just another virtue signaling from the right. And
either way, it's disgusting and dangerous. I think we're on the same page about that.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, I'm a big fan of the show, and I really appreciate you taking my call.
I appreciate it. Thanks. Thank you so much for calling in. Yeah, it's an important topic. It's part of this, like, they see themselves as waging a war, and part of that is you've got to show you're on the team. And so they say a lot of things they may not literally believe, but they might. Let's go next to Eddie from South Bend. Is that South Bend, Indiana?
Yeah, that's right. Can you hear me all right?
I can, Eddie. What's going on?
So I have possibly your first ever multiple choice call.
Okay.
So on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being a super softball question and 5 being what many are calling the greatest indictment of the David Backman show. So what would you like on a scale of 1 to 5?
Like, in other words, you have 5 different questions that I can choose from?
Yeah, number three is more like, I guess, a comment, but yeah, pretty much.
Let's not go with that. Let's go with a four. I'll take a tough question, but not like the toughest.
Okay, so, you know, I've been going back in your earlier videos, looking at some of your earlier opinions. Something you haven't talked about in a while is sort of representation and identity politics.
Okay.
So to some degree, there is, like, I would argue, an importance to these sorts of things. And I have a story, if you want it, from that, from an experiment my friend did. But in any case, I guess the question would be, to what degree would you sacrifice policy for identity in politics?
What do you even mean by that? I'd need to, what's an example of that? Can you give me an example of what it would mean to sacrifice policy for identity?
So let's say, for instance, like the Warren versus Bernie, right? So Warren was less good on policy than Bernie, but it would be, you know, a first woman presidential candidate. The example I have initially was a friend of mine did this experiment when she was a teacher in St. Louis, and this was during the riots down there. She had all of her students in their fourth grade class draw a scientist, and every one of them drew an older white man.
Okay.
And all the students were black, and not one of them drew a black person, and they were wondering why, and they were like, oh, well, that's not something I can do. And they weren't aware of any black scientists. So, you know, to what degree would you be willing to give in on some policies, if any, for the sake of, you know, giving representation to unrepresented groups?
So, I mean, my view on this really hasn't changed, which is I care about policy and not identity in terms of making decisions, but I still recognize the importance of identity in our understanding of the world. And so my opposition to identity politics has been, you can't use identity as a cudgel to silence people, to delegitimize voices. And so that's why I was, for example, so against when the Women's March said Jewish women weren't intersectional enough to be on the leadership. I was completely against that. I found that vile. In my analysis of the 2020 Democratic candidates, I didn't care about identity at all. I only cared about policy, et cetera. At the same time, there is no understating the importance and value and inspiration of, for example, we now have a female vice president for the first time. And it's the first, you know, there's all these other I don't even know all the categories. I'm so out of the identity game that I don't even know all the categories that Kamala Harris is part of. I think is there the Native American or Asian, you know, all these different things. Okay. There's no question that for young girls and young minority girls or all minority people, whatever, there's value in seeing that there is now an individual that checks certain boxes that for the first time is in this role. That there's no need to minimize that. What I'm against is using identity as a cudgel or as a weapon. And I don't know if that answers your question, but I think it's a complicated topic.
No, I agree. It's a super complicated. I think that's about where I'm at as well. I was kind of curious because in some of the videos I had seen, it seemed you were very much so like against identity politics, but thanks for the clarification. And like, you know,
yeah, I'm against identity politics, but I'm in favor of recognizing the value of identity and what it brings to our conversations of things.
That makes sense.
All right, my friend, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Let's see what else here. By the way, don't use my name on our Discord server. You're going to get banned for that. So use a real name. Don't say your name is David Pakman. That's not, we don't allow that. Let's try Zach from Orlando. Zach, you're on the air. Zach from Orlando, you're on the air.
Hey, David, can you hear me?
Just barely, Zach. Go ahead.
Yeah. So my question is, as someone who considers himself pretty far left, I look at countries like Denmark or Norway, Sweden, Canada, et cetera, as countries that I would like the United States to kind of emulate.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of conservative family members. I'm like the only one that's even left, I guess.
Okay.
And I never hear them talk about any other country in a good way. I was wondering, are there countries that the United of conservatives praise or think are good?
you know, I mean, you really have to ask them. But what's really, really funny is that for these kind of hardcore Christian Republicans, the countries that most match their moral values are radical Islamist countries that have, you know, many of them want a Christian version of what many of these Muslim countries have. And so it's often what they envision as ideal is like Saudi Arabia, et cetera, even though they claim not to like those countries. And it's a very interesting contrast. But you'd really have to ask them. I don't know what countries they like. A lot of them say they like what Duterte has done and cleaning things up and whatever. You know, we're talking about a dictator here. You'd really have to ask them. But there's some pretty serious hypocrisy there for sure.
Of course, yeah. Well, thank you very much for picking on me. I didn't think I'd get called on. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Great to speak to you. We're going to take a very, very quick break. If you're holding to talk to me, don't hang up, because we're going to go right back to the phones momentarily. Stand by. All right, let's get back to the phones. Last show before Thanksgiving. We're going to hear from a bunch of different people. DavidPakman.com/Discord is the place where you can contact me. Let's go right into it and see what's on people's minds. Let's go to, is it Boruch or Baruch from Miami, Florida? Boruch from Miami, you're on the air. Please unmute and you'll be able to talk to me. And last chance for Boruch from Miami, Florida. Last opportunity to unmute yourself. And that's too bad. Let's go to Matt from Northern California. Matt, you're on the air next.
Hey, check 1, 2, David, can you hear me?
You're coming in loud and clear, Matt.
David, thanks, man. I appreciate you taking the call.
Pleasure.
So as stated, I live in rural Northern California. We're about 2 hours north of San Francisco. And
so is that like Humboldt County pot area?
Just south. I'm part of the Emerald Triangle, Mendocino County, actually. That'll be Mendo, Humboldt, and Trinity County.
Got it.
You know it a little bit. So from where I'm sitting, it's just this really interesting nexus of rural sort of urban resentment mixed in with this infusion of kind of back to land, Berkeley liberal, organic, kind of culture clash. And mm-hmm. with that, the specific political moment we're in, I think, is this confusing identity crisis for especially like rural satellite counties of the Bay Area in Northern California. There's a lot of resentment towards San Francisco, you know, the rash of organized thefts recently, the COVID lockdowns. Also, there's this kind of libertarian common denominator in the resentment that's despite sort of some trappings of maybe some Trumpism, they're generally pro-gay marriage, they're pro-cannabis, but then sort of on the other political side, they're pro-firearm ownership. So, you know, I guess I'm just kind of curious about your perspective, David, on what Democratic messaging can do to start letting these, I think there's a huge place in the Democratic Party platform for a lot of these ideas, but there's some sort of communication breakdown and disconnect. And I'd love to know your thoughts on messaging. Have we given up on these populations? Is there an approach that you could see an inroad to get them considering the blue ticket?
Well, I hate to say this because it's such an important issue, but if you're talking about strategy, which is great, I love it. If we want to talk about strategy, you probably don't want to attack guns and gun owners. I mean, it's crazy to say it, but as we've looked at in a number of studies, when the topic of guns is a factor in elections, it tends to be good for Republicans and bad for Democrats. And it serves as a disincentive for people to vote for Democrats. So I'm the ultimate pragmatist. I'm not saying gun safety doesn't matter. I'm not saying we don't have a massive gun safety issue in the US. We do. But after the Sandy Hook shooting, with Barack Obama being president, had the House and Senate, still weren't able to get universal background checks passed, even with like 88 or 90% American support for it. That doesn't mean I'm saying we give up on the issue at all. Maybe it means you deal with it at the state level, or I'm not sure. But for the group you're talking about, where gun ownership is an issue, don't alienate people by talking about guns and making it central. Make economic issues central, et cetera. And again, I know people will be mad at me and they'll say, David, but the gun issue matters. I agree it matters, but I think it's bad strategy and it only serves to mobilize Republicans and others who might otherwise vote for Democrats but don't want to because of the perception that they're hostile to guns. So I think that's how I would start making inroads with the group that you're describing, Matt.
David, can I ask a follow-up question?
Yes, of course.
Regarding the specific issue of cannabis and the Democratic Party, we've found this really strange stalemate that's emerged regarding the federal legalization of cannabis. And recently, my understanding is there's been some talk on the Beltway of even Republicans starting to come out in support of the federal legalization.
Yes.
And I guess I have a concern that where you know, the Democrats could have put that feather in their cap and the can's gotten kicked long enough that, you know, maybe the Republicans will pick up that can and put that feather in their cap. So,
well, there's two sides to that. There's two sides to that. So you're rightly pointing out, hey, you know what? Democrats could have done more on federal marijuana, maybe not legalization, but at least decriminalization before Republicans start working on it and saying, we want that too. The thing is, I don't know that without Republican help, Democrats would really have been able to get it done. So I actually am not sure about that. But I do think that increasingly, at minimum, decriminalization is becoming more and more bipartisan, which is a great thing. I don't care who's in favor of it. Let's get it done.
Thank you, David. I appreciate your thoughts.
My pleasure. There's Matt from Northern California with a very powerful phone call coming in. Let's go. I don't know. Let's try Mike from Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, David, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, glad to be back. Called in last week. We had a good talk. Had a question regarding kind of like the larger scheme, like not so much larger scheme, larger scope of like the future of the United States. So we've seen over the last, 20 years, maybe a little bit more, that there is a slow but steady general trend towards not just like diversification of the population, but also just like a little more younger generations as they come up to be of voting age tend to be more liberal, more progressive than previous generations. And overall, they're slowly gaining ground. But what we've also seen is that as that builds up, a hostility and extremity of, the right wing and, maybe some people more willing to take action against what they perceive to be unethical or immoral people and policies also seems to be strengthening as well. And I guess my question is, do you see a point where this small but dangerous contingent of the right reaches a point where they see like they are ultimately going to lose the culture war, they're going to lose like the overall where the country swings in terms of politics, and just they reach a point where they just say, we have to, at least in their minds, we have to save the country and actually take action like they've been talking about for a while? When, like, do you think there's a point coming of that?
I would go further. I think it's already started, but for now, there aren't that many of them that are just willing to willy-nilly go and be violent yet. I think a lot of them are doing the violent rhetoric. I think a lot of them see themselves as, at a certain point, we will have to go and become violent in the real world. Some of them have, but yeah, I think that it's an absolutely legitimate concern. And when you look at long-term demographic trends, things are changing. And short of killing people, which I'm against and think is disgusting, there's a question as to how are they going to be able to resist it or push back against it. And I think they're going to become more radicalized. I think they're going to become more insular. A lot of this rhetoric has gone totally mainstream. I mean, remember the clips of Tucker Carlson saying on Fox News, immigrants make the country dirtier and poorer and stuff like that. So yes, I don't think it's hyperbolic to be worried that they're going to go even crazier as these changes continue to happen in the United States. And it's very scary.
So a follow-up question, if I may.
Yeah.
So we've seen a couple countries that used to be like solid democracies and now are only ostensibly democracies and
yes.
essentially are autocracies. The two prime examples in my mind right now are, and maybe there's more, but the two prime are Poland and Belarus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know the I don't know the careful details of their constitutions, what kind of checks and balances they ever had in place and whatnot. Obviously, that those could cause differences. But I mean, do you see something like what's happened in Poland theoretically possible here in the United States?
Well, where, the degree to which it's happened, I think Belarus maybe is a better example, but it's not a hypothetical in the sense that the U.S. for the first time a few days ago, we covered this story on Tuesday, was added to the list of backsliding democracies for the first time ever.
I missed that story. Disconcerting to know.
It's happening. It's happening now, unfortunately. And what we mean by backsliding democracy is a slide towards authoritarianism. So it's not, sadly, it's not a hypothetical. It's actually happening. And the question is, how far will it go? Obviously, I hope it doesn't go as far as it's gone in Belarus. But that is happening already, and it's horrifying.
One more, and then I promise I'll let you move on. I know you got a lot of people waiting. If that were to happen, do you see a possibility where the United States, as in like the 50 states, no longer exists down the road? And I don't mean like they've torn themselves apart from war. I mean, if something like what happens in Belarus, as you just said, possibly happens here, and we continue down this backsliding democracy path, do you think that certain states that, like, say, New England in the Northeast or maybe the West Coast, attempt to leave and get away from this backsliding democracy? Or do you think that whoever is trying to take control in an authoritarian kind of way forces their hand to stay?
You know, my view on that is these are essentially random guesses. Humans are so bad at making that type of prediction, which is why I say, you know, when Trump would say at the State of the Union, the U.S. will never be a socialist country, never is a really long time. And historically, nations fail. Things that are completely inconceivable take place. I have absolutely no idea on that. And I'm not going to pretend to really have an educated guess because I think we just don't know. Anything's possible.
Okay, fair enough. All right, I appreciate your time. I'm sure a lot of people are waiting to call in, so I'm sure I'll be calling in again, and have a good Thanksgiving.
All right, thanks, Mike. Likewise, Mike from Massachusetts with a number of important questions. Let's go next. Where are we going to go next? Let's go to Matt from Arizona. Matt, I'm going to be down in your neck of the woods very soon. Matt from Arizona, you're on the air.
I'm good, right?
That's you.
Okay, I'm so sorry. Bad connection.
All right, David, so I'll jump into my question. I want to utilize your master degree. I want to try and pick your brain. You know, a lot of the issues in the country have to do with money.
Mm-hmm.
Money is a human concept to me that we created, that we can get rid of if we want to. Obviously, it's not going anywhere. It creates great structure. It creates society. We have so much waste every year. Billions, billions, pounds. Wasted food, wasted resources, wasted anything. If we could make sure that everybody is doing well and is well off. To me, I could be wrong. But for you, using your master's degree, what would you say as far as, you know, the debt and deficit, all human created, we can get rid of, we can erase it, basically. Like, who do we owe? We have a debt. Who do we owe? However many trillions. Like, I just want to know your thought process on that.
So, you're putting together a few different issues, all of which are big. One is the concept of money. Two is hunger and food waste. Three is debt and deficit. I'm not sure I totally know exactly what you want me to weigh in on necessarily. Right. Are you saying, can't we just say we don't owe anybody any money? Or you're saying just digitally alter the money supply to create the amount we owe and then immediately pay it off? Or what?
Definitely not the latter. Definitely not that. Like, I understand, you know, inflation and all that. But what I'm saying is money is human created.
Yes.
So, you know, who do we owe? Like, if we could just make sure that everybody is not going and starving, like, there's literally humans in America.
But hold on. How does the hunger issue relate to the who do we owe issue? I don't know that I understand the connection.
It had to be do more like around, you know, this really opened my eyes around pandemic time, the heart of the pandemic, food lines in America.
Yeah.
You know, sending out stimulus checks to make sure people, you know, don't go hungry. You know, we could just be giving people food, or we could just be making sure people have a house to live in.
Yes,
or don't
I agree.
Freeze to death. So, you know, we have the resources.
Yes.
We have, you know, everything that a human would need and accommodate every human on the planet at the same time.
Yes.
So, you know, like, we have all these issues, but they're human created issues. Like, I don't...
Yeah. All right, Matt, listen, you're bringing up important issues. I'm not actually sure that there's really a question for me to answer there, so I'm going to let you go. But very important, you've identified important issues, and I think they are issues that we should be looking into very strongly, for lack of a better term. Let's try Andy in Nebraska next. Andy, what is your question today? You can jump right into it.
Oh, wow. Hey. I've got kind of a lighthearted question for you.
Sure.
Just about right-wing media. Sorry, it's a little disorienting listening to you in Discord versus your well-edited audio on YouTube. It's about the Gutfield show. Because I think you mentioned at one point that you've actually corresponded with Gutfield.
Greg Gutfeld, yes. Fox. I've exchanged some Twitter DMs with him, yeah.
So the show is, I don't think most of your viewers experience much of Fox News. Like, I came onto this show when I was at work. I work as like a, I work on long shifts. So it was a late night and the Gutfield show came on. Like, I, you know, it was the normal Fox montage of shows. And then the Gutfield show came on, and it was just this odd, unusual paradox of, like, trying to be a late-night show while...
Yeah, it's also got... It's like a comedy show. Andy, did you have a question for me today?
Yeah, I was just curious on your thoughts of that in Fox News, because the Gutfield show is just fascinating to me.
Yeah, the show is a joke. We've talked about how it tries to be a comedy show and it fails. It's not funny. And it tries to be a news show and it fails and it's not a news show. It's a very, very strange amalgam of different things. Andrew Yang, who was on this show recently, was recently on the Gutfeld show, and it was very strange. I think that Fox News has no idea what to do with that show. And so they're kind of feeling around in the dark and nothing really is working. So it'll be curious to see whether that show even survives. And that's something we're going to be following up on. All right, everybody, that's all the time I had today for calls. We're going to take a break and go through some of your emails and other things. We will take calls again, and I look forward to speaking to more of you coming up very, very soon. All right, let's get into this week's mailbag. If you want to participate, you can email info@davidpakman.com. Remember that we do get hundreds of emails every day. We feature about 8 to 10. So please, 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 with peace and love, don't get mad if yours doesn't make it on. Let's jump right in to one that is horrible, unfortunately. Really, really bad stuff. Why do Jews keep getting expelled? Asks H. Why were you people expelled from 109 countries if you did nothing wrong? Isn't that a bit strange? If you really think it over, if I got kicked out 109 times from every shop in the area, at what point should I recognize I'm doing something wrong? Not blaming all Jews, David, But certainly you people are doing something wrong. There's no anti-Semitism from me. My friends are Jewish. But at what point do we stop pretending that all Jews are innocent? Just asking questions. This, my friends, is a bona fide, classic anti-Semite. And I have Jewish friends. Do I really need to say more about that one? I'm feeling like the answer is no, so I won't. Let's continue. A sad message from Brady. Brady from Indiana says, "Hey, David, my family and I are in a bit of a situation. All of my family have been lifetime Republicans, but despite that, they're all vaccinated. That's good. But my sister is hesitant and refusing to get it due to misinformation. She believes the usual propaganda surrounding vaccine misinformation and is even thinking about taking ivermectin, even though we've told her the dangers. We've tried talking to her about it, but it always ends up in a fight or argument, and I'm kind of at a loss. She's even thinking about quitting her job due to the mandates. It's also hard on the family because we usually never argue over stuff like this. Do you have suggestions or advice? Appreciate it. Love the show. Keep up the great work. If you could not show my email if you cover this, that would be great." Of course, of course, of course, we are not showing your email address. We never would. Listen, here's the thing. I keep going back to the Socratic method of questioning, which is presumably her beliefs about the vaccine being bad and ivermectin being good are coming all from sources to some degree that she has a similar relationship to. She's chosen some media sources that say the truth about the vaccine, which she doesn't believe. And yet she's chosen some media sources that say things about ivermectin, which she does believe. And so often what I've heard from other viewers is when you explain to them, you're trusting sources on ivermectin with the same arbitrary nature with which you're not trusting sources about the vaccine. If you get them to come to the realization, that can be useful, but it's tough. It's very, very tough. I don't know that I have real advice beyond that, but let us know how it goes. And I'm sorry you're in that situation. Jeffrey wrote to me and said, "David, I think sometimes you can be hilarious. When you said yesterday, I don't know many race car drivers, and you said Butch Earnhardt, I literally laughed out loud. I don't agree with 90% of what you say, but I watch your show every day, and you make me laugh sometimes. Keep up the good work. Thanks for streaming the Rittenhouse trial, even though I'm sure it cost you in the long run." Yes, we are. I appreciate the kind words. We are now unbanned from Twitch. We were originally banned for 30 days due to a gory exhibit that was displayed on Twitch during our Rittenhouse stream. They, after 11 days with no explanation, unbanned us, and we're back on Twitch and have been streaming there this week. So it's all very opaque, but at the end of the day, we're glad to be back. Mark wrote in about the January 6th alleged Trump rioter who has fled to Belarus, entering the country illegally and now asking for asylum. Mark says, "American in Belarus, not a traitor. David, it's Mark from Germany. I know the GOP, as well as Trump and his supporters, love using the terms treason and traitor whenever it's politically convenient, with Trump often talking about the good old days when people were executed for treason, despite Trump never referring, I think it means never referring to a real case of treason. I'm now curious whether the political right will call the Capitol attacker, who's avoiding justice by illegally entering and seeking asylum in Belarus, a traitor too. In my opinion, this is a perfect example of treason if we follow the usual right-wing narrative." Of course, the people saying law and order, the people saying due process, the people saying all those things should be saying, wait a second, the Trump rioter who fled to Belarus was charged under the law, was being afforded due process, is wrongly claiming that he's going to be tortured and all that the prosecution is illegitimate, and has decided to flee and illegally enter a different country. They're not saying it because they don't actually care. Their principles are only their principles as far as they're convenient to them. And when the principles are no longer convenient, they abandon them. But of course, Mark from Germany is 100% correct. This is kind of funny. Every once in a while, I get an email that makes me wonder whether I've lost my mind. Colin wrote to me when I asked last week about, "Can you help me find the show in which I did an Alex Jones impression?" And Colin says, I think the caller is referencing your Nixon impression from a few days back. Unless I have completely lost my mind, I have not done a Nixon impression on this program, at least for years, maybe never. And when I see this, like from Colin, who says the caller is referring to your Nixon impression, I start to wonder whether I've lost my mind. But we checked, we looked. I definitely didn't do a Nixon impression. I don't know what it's all about, but it's interesting. Brett wrote in about COVID boosters and says, hey, David, considering how many considering many Americans received their second COVID shot in April and May, and it appears we need a booster shot at 6 months, should we expect a rise in breakthrough cases over the next months? Well, we don't have to wonder, Brett. We are seeing it. We are seeing a significant increase in cases in the United States. Now, I just got my third dose a week and a half ago, and I'm glad that I did. The question has been, is it every 6 months or does the third dose provide longer protection? So far, we have good looking data from Israel, which seems to say with a third shot, the protection lasts longer. It doesn't seem to start to wane at 6 months. Now, that's what it seems like right now. The virus can evolve, it can change, etc. And then a lot of these beliefs can change. But right now, cases are going up. And what's really crazy is there are more people in the US right now getting third shots than getting first shots. In other words, a bunch of the people now showing up as getting doses are already vaccinated to some degree. And that doesn't bode particularly well for our path towards herd immunity. So that's not good. We talked about Ron DeSantis earlier this week, and Matthew wrote in and said, hey, David, why should we be scared of Ron DeSantis? He seems like a regular corporate Republican, not a Trumpist. At least when I see him speak, it's just regular Republican talking points, not necessarily Trumpist things. I'm sure if he becomes president, I'll disagree with a lot of his policies and sure he's an ass, but why should we be scared he'll destroy our democracy like Trump did if he became president? I completely, completely disagree with Matthew. Ron DeSantis is a very Trumpian Republican. He has a lot of Donald Trump's worst instincts to do the opposite of what the science says on COVID, to push these big lies about election fraud. And he announced a few weeks ago he's opening a commission or something to investigate election fraud. It's like, no, nobody, Trump won Florida. Nobody's even calling into question Florida. He is bonkers out of his mind, but horrifyingly, he is more competent than Donald Trump. So I completely disagree that Ron DeSantis is just kind of a regular Republican. If you look at Mitt Romney and Ron DeSantis, there's very little in common. Very, very little. I'm not praising Mitt Romney. I'm just stating a fact. There is no comparison between DeSantis and real non-Trump Republicans like Mitt Romney, the late John McCain, the late Colin Powell, and others. And we got to be very, very scared if Ron DeSantis is the 2024 nominee. Aaron says about Kyle Rittenhouse, Kyle is a depreciating political commodity. Regardless of the trial outcome, Kyle is a depreciating political commodity that will end up worthless after his 2 weeks of fame are over. He will never have a substantive career. One Google search will destroy his any chance he has of making anything of himself. Well, unless it's in right-wing media and right-wing agitation, I do agree that after the not guilty verdicts from last week, Rittenhouse is definitely getting his 15 minutes of fame, appearing on Fox News, being flown all around, and he's definitely getting some fame right now. I do agree that in terms of getting a normal job, working as if he ever actually becomes an EMT or whatever, it seems he's got an uphill climb ahead of him. But I wouldn't be shocked if Rittenhouse ends up being a successful firearms YouTuber. I wouldn't be shocked if Rittenhouse ends up as a CPAC speaker. In that space, I actually think he probably does have a future now that he's being lionized and being made a hero out of. But I do think that his usefulness will be quite limited to that. And I'm curious to see, I mean, by January, how many people are talking about him? I don't know. We're going to wait and see. Jeremy wrote in and said, hey, David, can't Joe Biden use an executive order to pass the original $3.5 trillion Build Back Better plan? Regards, Jeremy. No, my research is that he cannot. and that something like the $3.5 trillion Build Back Better plan needs to go through Congress. It relates to appropriating money, and it is not something that Joe Biden can do via executive order. I don't even know that I need to say more about it, because my understanding is that cut and dry, that very, very simple and straightforward. If someone has a different perspective on that, could Joe Biden implement elements of Build Back Better through executive order? Maybe. Let me know. But no, my research, and we have looked at it very strongly, is you can't pass Build Back Better via executive order. And lastly today, Chris wrote in, and Chris says, thank you. This is just like a nice message. We don't get that many of these. Thank you. Hey, David, I've been watching your show for a while. I very much appreciate what you do. You've consistently been a voice of reason in the left-wing space online. It hasn't gone unnoticed that you understand how the type of content you put out affects people in real life. I know it would be easy to grab more views to put out a spicy Fauci video or cover conspiracies, but you understand that only serves to create more doubt around the effort to save lives. I've had a few people in my life pass away from COVID-19, and all of them watched prominent YouTubers or online podcasters who were, quote, only asking questions about COVID and the COVID vaccines. You care about your audience, and we can see it. Your work is invaluable. Thank you. Chris, thank you. I really appreciate that. And, you know, it can be very easy to focus on, like the first email that I showed you, disgusting anti-Semitism directed specifically at me. And it's great to hear from Chris. I really appreciate that. Remember that we are going to be off tomorrow, Thursday for Thanksgiving and Friday for Thanksgiving. We will then be back on Monday. Federal Thanksgiving holiday here in the United States. Everybody taking a much needed break. And we will be back with you Monday. But before that, there's the bonus show. If you're a member at joinpacman.com, come sign up at joinpacman.com. You can get access to the bonus show. Otherwise.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Automation is the key. I am Dr. Jazz, PhD.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And I'm Mary.
From High
Places.
And you're listening to WRCT.
88.3 FM. A radio station.
From New York, Rock Raider.
Yeah, yeah, 1-2, Total Eclipse.
From Executioners, I'm chilling on WRCT.
Word up, Pittsburgh representing 88.3 FM.
Check
on
it out,
dial. All right? Peace.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that's where things like this go, right down the drain.
WRCT is the best place to be. He sends the music out your way 40 hours every day.
Hi, this is Felicia Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
We are Microwaves, reminding you that the most important things in life are to crush your enemies,
to see them driven before you,
and to hear the lamentations of their women while listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. 88.3 FM.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey, this is Ben Foles, and you're listening to WRCT. It's 2 for Tuesday, 3 for Thursday, Ladies Night Wet T-Shirt Contest on 88.3 FM, biatch.
Thank you.
Hi, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, home of... Oh, crap. We're not really home of anything, are we, Andrew?
Hello, I'm Meg Lee Chin, and when I'm in town, I like to listen to WRCT 88.3 FM.
Yo, there's only 6 degrees of separation, and we know 5 people you know. How much longer did you really think you could avoid strict flow? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. Like this!
This is WRCT. This is WRCT. Come on and stay with us a while. Big 900 on your dial. We'll make your day a great big smile. WRCT.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
First of all, we were taken as hold for ransom. Then I was sold to the CIA as Al-Qaeda general, middle-aged Egyptian, you know, a nine of insider. I was taken to the black site, where I was like tortured for like over 2 months. Then from the black site to Kandahar detention.
Today, a Democracy Now! Special. We spend the hour with Mansour Adaifi. He was imprisoned at Guantanamo for over 14 years after being sold as a teenager to the CIA by an Afghan warlord after the 9/11 attacks. By the time he was released, he'd spent half his life in U.S. custody, but was never charged with a crime. He'll talk about being tortured and why he repeatedly went on hunger strike to protest inhumane conditions.
We were hurting ourselves. I always tell the people, you know, our bodies was the battlefield because Americans torture us, abuse us, and beat us. And in our bodies, also we were torturing our bodies by hunger strike, by trying to resist. And I wrote about it, the hunger strike. It was a slow journey to death, toward death. That's hunger strike.
Mansour Adaifi will talk about his new memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo, and how art helped him and others survive Guantanamo.
Art connects us to the world outside. You can see the brothers, we paint, see trees. The things we missed most, sky, the stars, you know, homes, deserts, and so on.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a Democracy Now! Special. We spend the hour with Mansour Adaifi. At the age of 18, he left his home in Yemen to do research in Afghanistan. Shortly before he was scheduled to return home, he was kidnapped by Afghan warlords and sold to the CIA for a bounty after the September 11th attacks. He was jailed and tortured in Afghanistan, then transported to the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo in 2002, where he was held without charge for 14 years, many of those years in solitary confinement. Mansour became known as Detainee 441. In 2016, he was released against his will to Serbia, which he compares to Guantanamo 2.0. By the time Mansour was released, he'd spent more than half of his life locked up. Mansour Adaifi has just published his memoir. It's called Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. I spoke to him in September from his home in Belgrade. I began by asking him to talk about how he ended up at Guantanamo.
Okay, let's fly back like 38 years, which actually when people ask me how old are you, I said like 24 because I didn't count Guantanamo, like try to cheat. Anyway, I born in a tiny village in Yemen, Raima. Born like with 11 brothers and sisters, large family, very conservative family. Until I studied my primary school and secondary school in the village, we had no high school, so I had to go and live with my aunt in the capital Sana'a, which like new world. When I finished with my high school, I was assigned to do some as the research in Afghanistan. I was like a research assistant in Afghanistan. This is how my journey started there. In Afghanistan, I spent a couple of months researching and doing some of the research required to be done